Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, High Wire Politics at Home and Abroad this week, and a warning of rough weather ahead on the economy. Pakistani General Pervez Musharraf said he'd take off his military uniform and hold parliamentary elections. But with the constitution scrapped, his opponent, Benazir Bhutto, now under house arrest, was skeptical.
He told me I'll take my uniform off before I seek re-election as president of Pakistan. He never did. He told the Supreme Court, I will take my uniform off before I take my oath. He never did.
At home, lots of 08 endorsements from the religious right. Reverend Pat Robertson threw his arm around the socially liberal but super hawkish Rudy Giuliani.
To me, the overriding issue before the American people is the defense of our population from the bloodlust of Islamic terrorists.
Fed Chief Ben Bernanke warns of a slowing economic growth. With oil sky high and the dollar still falling, Wall Street feared worse. Here's one analyst.
The big question, the $64,000 question is the economy slowing enough so that it'll go into recession?
We've got a great panel to look across this week's top stories. But first, a look straight at oil and recession fears. With the dollar falling, oil prices soaring, and the subprime mortgage mess still on, Wall Street was very skittish this week. Zanny Mitten-Beddoes is U.S. economics editor for The Economist magazine. She joins us from Washington. Zanny, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
So, perfect storm time. I mean, there's so many things coming together here at once. What is on the line here? Just recession potentially? Or, I don't know, is there something worse out there?
Well, there's certainly potentially recession. There are, as you say, a lot of things coming together. The specter of 100 barrel a dollar oil, what that means for the consumer, the sense that credit conditions are really tightening as banks seem to have even bigger problems than people feared. Both of those will aggravate consumer spending. The tighter credit conditions will aggravate the housing downturn. All of that means that the spending looking forward doesn't look so great, and the risk is, of course, that it weakens the labor market. The labor market has really been quite strong until recently, but if labor market weakens too, then you really do have all the ingredients for recession.
Why such big wobbles on Wall Street this week?
Well, I think the big wobbles from Wall Street originate from uncertainty about how bad the credit crunch is and how big a problem that's going to be and how that's then going to infect the rest of the economy through these channels we've talked about. At the same time, there is this shadow of $100 barrel oil. What does that mean going forward? And Wall Street, you know, Wall Street have been reacted quite extraordinarily over the past couple of months. If you remember, after the Fed first cut interest rates on September the 18th, Wall Street had this huge rally, as though the whole turmoil of the summer had kind of never happened, or if it happened, was finished and done with. And I think a lot of what's happening now is a realization that this credit turmoil is a really big deal, that there's a lot of debt to be written off, that there are a lot of problems that spawned from subprime. There is a lot of adjustment that needs to take place, and that's going to have a knock-on effect on the economy.
Here's Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke testifying before Congress, the Joint Economic Committee, yesterday.
Certainly, as homeowners see their wealth declining in terms of their house value, that will affect their thinking about long-term their long-term spending opportunities and affect their spending. We do not take an alarmist view on this, however.
Zanny, are people looking at this as cyclical or some kind of structural change? We read the headlines this morning. We've got the first demand-driven oil problem here. Before it was a problem with supply. Now demand just overwhelming the supply. Ben Bernanke, his options potentially limited because dollar's down. He has to be careful about inflation. Maybe only so much he can do on interest rates. Is there fear that the parameters are changing?
There is a risk that the Fed is, as you said, between a kind of rock and a hard place. There is the risk of a mild version of what we had in the 70s of stagflation, because on the one hand, you have the risks to the economy rising. If you look backwards, the economy has been remarkably resilient.
Yes.
The economy. And even if you look back over the past few months, the numbers that we've had out have been pretty incredible. You know, in the third quarter, between July and September, even as the credit crunch started, the economy grew by 3.9%. Last month, in October, 166,000 new jobs created.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that does not suggest the economy is about to go into recession.
Right.
But yet, if you look forward, as we've talked about, everything is looking pretty gloomy, from credit to the housing market to the oil price. And then at the same time, the oil price and the falling dollar between them raise the specter of inflationary pressure. And you've seen inflation expectations, people's expectations of where inflation is going to go, have risen slightly. They haven't become completely unanchored, but they have risen slightly. And that really puts the central bank in a bit of a bind, because what you absolutely don't want to do is to allow people's expectations of inflation to become loose or to rise. On the other hand, and if you're worried about that, then that limits how much you can cut interest rates.
And
on the other hand, I also have a suspicion that given that a lot of this is linked to the housing market and this big glut of excess housing and
yes.
the housing price declines, the impact of looser monetary policy, of lower interest rates, may be much less powerful than it was, say, in the shallow recession that followed the stock market crash in 2000-2001. When you know the Fed cut interest rates very sharply, and that buoyed the housing market, which in turn buoyed consumer spending. This time around, you have the housing market in a slump, and so that channel is no longer so effective.
So if you cut interest rates, what? It means that housing might just absorb it? It keeps
well,
you from heading into inflation?
It could be that they are less powerful at stimulating the economy than they might otherwise be.
At a time when Bernanke...
At a time but when you are also worried, if you're the central bank, about inflation from the dollar and from high commodity prices. So there is a sense in which that you could be facing two whammies. And that's, I think, part of the reason why the markets are so completely uncertain right now.
A lot of whammies on the board at once. Sandy Mittenbettis, we'll have to come back and talk with you more on that. Thanks for taking us in for a moment today.
My pleasure.
Zanny Mittenbettis, U.S. Economics Editor for The Economist magazine. Joining me now from New York is Amy Sullivan, Nation Editor and writer for Time magazine. Her book coming up is The Party Faithful, How and Why Democrats Are Closing the God Gap. Amy Sullivan, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us from Washington is Michael Garrison, speechwriter and policy advisor to President Bush from 2001 to 2006, and very influential when he coined the phrase compassionate conservatism. Now he's a columnist for The Washington Post, a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is Heroic Conservatism, Why Republicans Need to Embrace America's Ideals and Why They Deserve to Lose If They Don't. Michael Garrison, welcome to On Point.
Good to be with you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, welcome.
Hello, Tom, Amy, and Michael.
Michael Garrison, first to you. You're on the Council on Foreign Relations. The whole country is watching what's going on in Pakistan. We said house arrest. I don't know what to call it. They've got, you know, military and barbed wire outside Benazir Bhutto's house, trying to stop by means of force a big demonstration there in Rawalpindi. Is the United States yet on the right side of this crisis in Pakistan?
Well, Americans should be watching. I mean, the stakes could hardly be higher. You're talking about terrorism and the bomb. This is a case where Musharraf is on a tremendous tightrope. He's trying to reassure the administration and the world community with a couple of reassuring statements about taking off the uniform, elections in February. At the same time, he doesn't want street demonstrations because they could easily spiral out of control. And the fact here is that the military, the army, is very much in control. And if they were to turn on him because he is discrediting their cause, his term could be over. The administration faced two choices when this happened. You know, Condi Rice urged him not to do it by telephone 2 days beforehand. But they faced two choices. One of them is to encourage somebody to replace him, essentially to look for change. The other one was to try to gradually bring him back onto the reservation and to make some commitments and reform. And they took the second course. I think both courses were difficult, but they calculated that one was more likely to lead to a good outcome.
President Bush called him up. No sign of an aid cutoff, and of course billions go there, but he did call Pakistan's general, President Musharraf, to voice opposition to the emergency rule declared.
My message was that we believe strongly that in elections, and that you ought to have elections soon, and you need to take off your uniform. You can't be the president and the head of the military at the same time. So I had a very frank discussion with him.
We heard Benazir Bhutto's skepticism earlier about Musharraf taking off his uniform. She's also expressed skepticism about these parliamentary elections to be held sometime, maybe February.
It's a little vague to say it will be held by February. That's not an election schedule. That's not an election date. We want an election date.
Amy Sullivan, do you see Washington putting the kind of pressure on Pakistan and Musharraf that says no to a state of emergency, no to a scrapped constitution, or are they in effect giving him cover? Take off your uniform, but don't bring the constitution back necessarily.
Well, as Michael said, they're in a very tough position. They've got a couple of not very good options. And I would say it makes it almost even more difficult for them that Musharraf has invoked the war on terror, the need to go after these extremist elements in his country, as a reason to really consolidate his power, consolidate executive power in Pakistan, because at a very lower level, but still the same argument, that's the debate that has been going on in this country when you look at things like the executive power struggles that we've had between Congress and the president, when you look at debates over things like waterboarding and what's acceptable to invoke in the name of going after the global war on terror. I think that sets up, again, they're not equivalent situations, but it sets up a very difficult argument for the administration because you lose a bit of your moral high ground when you've invoked this argument on your own to then go after someone who is supposed to be one of your key allies in taking on the terrorist threat and tell them that this is unacceptable.
Wow, Jack Beatty, that sets up a very stark parallel for the president of the United States. They got state of emergency in Pakistan.
It does indeed, but I hope we can come back to this for a moment because it's how we got here, I think, that's worth commenting on.
We're looking at a week in the news, oil high, dollar low, a new attorney general, faith-based endorsements on the campaign trail in Pakistan. In Trouble, Amy Sullivan is with us, nation editor and writer for Time magazine, author of the forthcoming The Party Faithful. Michael Gerson is here from Washington, longtime speechwriter and policy advisor to President George W. Bush, now a columnist for The Washington Post, contributor to Newsweek. His new book is Heroic Conservatism. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to Eric in Boston. Eric, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think?
I was struck when I was listening to President Bush ask Musharraf to change what he had been doing when he said, "You can't be president and head of the army at the same time." Isn't Bush just that?
Well, he's commander-in-chief, but he's not in uniform. He's the civilian interlink, and that's been a pretty firm and clear line. But, of course, you want the army to respond to the civilian in the end. Jack Beatty, I mean, how far are we going to take this parallel?
Yeah, I don't think that goes very far. You know, President Bush did say something a couple of years ago that applies to this situation. He talked about what he called, quote, false stability. That is, it came from Western governments relying on dictatorships. And we have had in Pakistan false stability. The General Musharraf has played this administration and indeed the Congress like a drum. He had, you know, on his side of the ledger, he said after 9/11 that he was going to crack down on the madrasas. They've increased, by some reports, by a factor of three times. He will not allow Western intelligence services to interview scientists who participated in the Khan nuclear proliferation
yep.
network. He made peace deals with the tribes in the northeast that protect Al Qaeda in Quetta. The Taliban even has an office. And then on the other side, where we had leverage, we haven't used it. $10 billion in aid, and from what I read, much of it simply a cash transfer with no accountability and no requirement from him. And what's been the result of this? Well, the result of it is that the United States is only one country in the world is it less popular than Pakistan, and that's Turkey. People there understand that we have backed this dictator and that we have not asked questions. And meanwhile, we have not got anything out of him because he's been playing a double game. Mm. And you know, false stability indeed. And maybe finally this administration and Congress is waking up to the idea that we have to use leverage to show the Pakistani people that this a dictator isn't our only option there.
Michael Garrison, you spent a lot of time in the Bush White House. What do you make of Amy Sullivan's suggestion that there's a kind of parallel here, that the expansion of executive power within the Bush White House makes this White House a bit sympathetic in a war on terror to expanded executive power, now emergency powers in, let's say, Pakistan?
I guess my response would be that in Musharraf's case, it's much more of a pretext than a reason. I mean, his real motivation was that the, you know, the Supreme Court of his country was about to rule that his election was illegitimate. And so his first actions were to essentially put his own people on the Supreme Court. I think in this case, I think if you were to talk to people in the administration, they would say that this action has actually made Pakistan less stable. It's complicated the war on terror instead of increasing, its effectiveness. And their view is that the most effective war on terror in Pakistan would be conducted by a consensus government with a representative government, of which, you know, Bhutto would probably be a part. That's what they've been pushing for, but they haven't been willing to push for it in destabilizing ways. And you can argue that back and forth, but it's the same dynamic with Saudi Arabia. These in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, they became very necessary in elements of America's anti-terror policy. They've not cooperated fully, but they've cooperated partially. And so the question is, do you try to seek a new order, a new approach in those countries? And there are risks to that side, too.
Amy Sullivan, a tough commentary in a way now on President Bush's claim we're going to push democracy right across this region. Michael points to Saudi Arabia, not exactly a democracy. And now Pakistan, way out of that category at the moment anyway.
Well, yes, it certainly raises the very real challenge. It's a good ideal, and it certainly has really rallied people to the extent that they still support the war in Iraq and they still support our efforts in the Middle East. That is the one issue that really gets people together, is the idea that we could, in fact, through our intervention, bring about democracy in some countries that just simply haven't had it. The problem is that runs into the reality of dealing with leaders like Musharraf and needing to work through the best that you have on the ground. And in this case, the administration tried kind of a middle effort in bringing in Bhutto and trying to encourage the power-sharing agreement, and it simply didn't work.
And now we've got Benazir Bhutto shouting to reporters across rolls of barbed wire around her house. I've seen an awful lot of Pakistanis in the streets, and there she is. I mean, it may be hard to argue that Musharraf is the best option necessarily that the country has there. All of this played in a way into presidential politics this week. We heard Pat Robertson at the top of the hour coming up and saying, well, I'm for Giuliani because he's going to go after the bloodlust of Islamic terrorists. Let's listen a little more to Pat Robertson endorsing the former New York mayor. Despite Giuliani's social positions, which don't line up with a lot of religious right positions, he emphasized Giuliani's strong position on fighting Islamic terrorism, he called it.
I wish Rudy Giuliani success in the caucuses and primaries, which will take place in a few months. And beyond that, it is my hope and prayer that he will lead the Republican Party to victory in November of 2008.
Here's Rudy Giuliani responding to Reverend Pat Robertson's endorsement.
Having him aboard gives us a great deal of confidence because he has tremendous insights into what the main issues are, how they should be dealt with. His advice is invaluable, and his friendship even more invaluable.
Michael Gerson, do some interpreting for us here. You know this community well. It's a kind of divided evangelical right at this point. And in one week, we had there Robertson and Giuliani. We had Paul Weyrick and Romney. We had Senator Sam Brownback, very popular in this community, throwing his arms around John McCain. What do you make of it all, Michael?
Well, I wouldn't, first of all, overestimate the continuing influence of Pat Robertson. The organization he led is a shadow of its former self. I think there are many people in the evangelical community that have moved beyond that model of social engagement. But it's still useful for Giuliani for one reason. Because he wants it divided. He doesn't want social conservatives to coalesce around a single candidate that would challenge his dominance and leadership in the primaries. So you had all these, Brownback with McCain. You have Dobson, James Dobson out in Colorado Springs recently saying that he may bolt the party rather than accept Giuliani. So that kind of diversity ultimately is hurting people like Mike Huckabee, governor of Arkansas, who you would think normally would get a lot of the support of religious right people. He's very much a conservative, very much on that model. But many of them are calculating in different ways about who's electable, about, you know, kind of bank shot endorsements. And right now, this divided movement is not having very much influence.
Amy Sullivan, you watch this closely. What do you make of it? And of the particular way that these individuals have broken, Robertson, Weyrich, Brownback, how do you interpret it?
Well, I would definitely agree with Michael that I think Pat Robertson's influence is often overstated by my colleagues in the media. In fact, I try to remind them as often as possible that the only people who really listen to Pat Robertson are journalists, that most of my fellow evangelicals don't consider him to speak for the community. And I'm not sure that his endorsement really moves that many votes on the ground. I actually think that Sam Brownback, although his presidential campaign never ended up really getting off the ground, may actually have more of an impact in terms of voters in the base who look to him and to see where his vote is going. And in fact, this came before the Brownback announcement. But the most recent Washington Post poll, if you break it down among evangelicals in the Republican community, shows that more evangelicals are moving back to John McCain. I think it's about 23% now of evangelicals in the Republican electorate who are likely primary voters say that they would support John McCain. And as we know, he's had his issues with the religious right, calling Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell in 2000 agents of intolerance. Mm-hmm. But it seems that at least some Republican voters may have taken a look at this field and decided by this point, you know, he may be the best that they've got, or at least he's not any worse than their other options.
Not fully showing up in the polls there yet, but let's listen just for a second to Sam Brownback on exactly that point. He says evangelicals are not divided, they're just undecided.
They're undecided, they're not divided. It's kind of like, okay, which person is it here that you would support? John McCain's got a 24-year pro-life voting record.
Jack Beatty, I mean, maybe that is the point. After all, it's before the primaries. Everybody can rally around one candidate later. Does it matter if evangelical support, like support from other quarters, goes to a bunch of different candidates?
I don't think it does, and I think following the Bush, you know, the Bush model for in 2000 just isn't replicable now. I mean, there was a rallying around him, and that was that once the Bauer candidacy had failed. But, you know, just to return to this Robertson matter, it is so ironic that Rudy should take this endorsement because Pat Robertson, and famously in that interview with Jerry Falwell just after 9/11, said that that 9/11 had happened because God had withdrawn his protection from America because of the depredations of the ACLU, People for the American Way, the allowance of gays in public life, and abortion, and on and on. And then, in effect, he agreed with Falwell that we deserved it. And then he claimed, well, I didn't hear it in my earpiece. But if you look on his website, he has practically said the same things himself. So here's Rudy, who in a debate with Ron Paul, when Ron Paul said our foreign policy is the reason that we've been attacked abroad, Rudy said, I've never heard that. Of course, the Defense Intelligence Agency said just that. But now he's taking the endorsement of a man who said 9/11 happened because God took away his shield from America. I mean, it is really something. Politics makes strange bedfellows.
Michael Gerson, is it corrosive for the evangelical right to do bank shots and, you know, calculate who can win rather than who they should support on principle? And what do you make of Robertson saying, look, never mind all the rest, I'm with Rudy because he can, you know, stand up to the bloodlust of Islamic terrorists?
Well, to be honest, I think it looks pretty cynical. It looks very much like Robertson wants to be on the Republican train, no matter where it's going. And the other side looks like self-destructive purity. Leaving the party, you know, would be pretty much to elect
the James Dobson
Hillary Clinton
position.
Or whoever the nominee is. I think it's an indication of the exhaustion and maybe even bankruptcy of the model of social engagement of the religious right. There's so many evangelicals who are trying to look beyond it. to some other model. If you look at Rick Warren or you look at other examples, they're people that, you know, have a broader social concern than just the traditional social issues. They're interested in poverty in Africa, and they're interested in human trafficking, and they're interested in issues of race and poverty. And they're looking for ways to express this, but the old line leadership is really not doing that.
It's kind of interesting to see the lines in motion there. Karen is calling from Stoneham, Massachusetts. Hi, Karen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just have a question. I guess it sort of follows up on about the lines being moving. I don't think it's just the evangelicals that are sort of trying to reposition themselves. And I know that Bush's policies, foreign policy, and his aborted social policies, the things that he's announced that he wanted to change, have really made me feel that the Republican Party is certainly not an option I want to support anymore.
And what are you thinking of there, Karen? What policies in particular?
Well, I remember the big push he was going to do to solve AIDS, and you know, that was at the very beginning of
the compassionate conservative agenda, in a way.
Right, and that's been totally dumped. And I certainly
think I need to respond to that.
I'll give you a chance, Michael, and wrap it there, Karen. So you think what's happening, that there's a blurring of lines between the parties, even?
Yeah, I think it's, I really do. I wonder if there's a lot of uncertainty. I think I sort of hear it sometimes when callers call up, they say they identify themselves as a liberal or a conservative, and then they voice support for something that would go against that agenda. You know, they'll start explaining why they think about the other side as
right.
well.
Right, it's very interesting.
I've
heard that as well, Karen, and thank you for that. Michael Garrison, first of all, on the compassionate conservative approach, is it still viable? Is anybody going to embrace that in 08 on the GOP side? And what about the blurring of lines? Do you see it?
Yeah. Well, in the narrow issue of AIDS, of course, the president pushed for a $15 billion initiative that is actually overfunded right now, has nearly a million people on ARV treatments and is headed towards having 2 million people on AIDS drugs. I've seen that result all over Africa and Ethiopia and Namibia and South Africa. It's one of the most extraordinary humanitarian efforts in American history. And it's something the American people who are funding it should be proud of and know more about. Mm-hmm. Because all over Africa, people know. They know the word PEPFAR, which is the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief. No one in America knows about it. But I do think there's a significant backlash in the Republican Party right now to some of these more idealistic policies, a kind of anti-government backlash, a libertarian backlash, deep skepticism of government spending that I think is undermining an effective Republican message. It's one of the cases I make in the book. If they're talking about procedures and money while others are talking about education, healthcare, problems of poverty, then I think they're going to be handicapped on their domestic message, as the Republican Party has been in the past. So I've been pushing for Republicans to adopt conservative and free market methods to approach these issues of social justice and add something to the debate. But if you look at the Republican debate right now, John McCain has some of that, Mike Huckabee has some of that, but for the most part, it's a gap.
Amy Sullivan, is that, I don't know, disarray pushing it all into the lap of the Democrats?
It might. I would say instead of pushing people into Democratic arms, it at least gives Democrats an opportunity, if they are smart enough and choose to reach out to voters who they have not traditionally spent a lot of time talking to. I think one of the things this election is showing us is it's throwing everything we thought we knew about politics up in the air, and we don't yet know how it's going to come down. You know, on the right, I think Michael's right, the candidate who probably best embodies the compassionate conservative ideas is Mike Huckabee, and yet he's being called a liberal by some of his opponents. And on the right, you've got folks like Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama reaching out to religious communities and forming relationships with evangelicals.
Striking writers, homeless vets, and country music speaking up this week. Hollywood striking writers got a boost when the on-screen talent joined them on the picket line.
Writers, we're all in this together. Actors, writers, we're all in this together.
Veterans Day this weekend, a new survey found ex-soldiers make up a quarter of the nation's homeless, and Washington Army veteran Ben Israel spoke up.
I've been out there. I've been homeless. Miami, Dallas, Portland, Oregon, Atlanta, here, Raleigh, North Carolina, and other areas.
And Carrie Underwood took home Female Vocalist of the Year at the Country Music Awards in Nashville. Lots going on this week on many fronts. Amy Sullivan is with us from Time Magazine. Her forthcoming book, The Party Faithful, How and Why Democrats Are Closing the God Gap. Michael Gerson is here. He wrote speeches and advised President George W. Bush from 01 to 06. His new book is Heroic Conservatism, Why Republicans Need to Embrace America's Ideals. Rita's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Rita. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
For me, the week was a week of hypocrisy on pretty much every front, from the international to the national to even some local things going on.
Well, we're human. There's always hypocrisy. What's the worst of it?
Well, I think the pervasiveness. As I was listening, I the discussion about, well, Americans should be proud of the money we're spending in Africa for AIDS treatment. Well, that's good, but the hypocrisy of that one is that we're not spending money on AIDS prevention, because condoms would be birth control, which this administration refuses to spend money on. And that just is hypocrisy.
Yeah, Michael Gerson, that's right back in your wheelhouse, and where compassion,
yeah, no,
conservatism, and values issues rub up against each other. Yeah.
Right. The reality here is, in the first 4 years of the emergency plan for AIDS relief, the number of condoms in the focus countries increased by 70%.
With American help or with American resistance?
No, I think this is through USAID. And the reality is that on the ground in Africa, they don't have these cultural war debates. They believe in A, B, and C.
But there have been times when the United States pushed its sort of domestic values agenda abroad during the Bush administration as part of, you know, right along with family planning debate and AIDS and all the rest.
Well, that could well be, but the react on AIDS, this is a deference to African approaches. Hmm. Very much they believe in A, which is abstinence, B, which is be faithful within marriage, and C, which is consistent condom use. And you've seen in countries that have controlled AIDS, Kenya and other places, that they have increases in all these areas: delayed sexual activity, increased condom use in high-risk sexual activity, and less multiple concurrent partners, which is the B problem, which is really a women's issue in Africa, because they're the ones who suffer when men sleep around. So the reality here is, I think that this debate, which is rages on the right in America, that we're, you know, they oppose condoms, and they, on the left in America, that somehow we're burning all the condoms in Africa, it has very little relationship to what's going on in the ground.
Let's get a call from Dan in Braintree, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Great topics today. I just wanted to limit myself to the economic situation. As I read it, we're facing a major inflation alert at this point due to a kind of convergence of some several factors. Social Security coming due for the baby boomers, our international debt, the Iraqi war debt, our infrastructure debt, the falling dollar, and the tremendous increase in competition for oil and other commodities from China, India, and other countries, which has never occurred before to the level that it has now. But the question I have for your guest is the subprime housing crisis, which is on top of all this, a means to control inflation here at home due to loss of purchasing dollars from the baby boomer group, which would have benefited tremendously.
You mean you see a conspiracy at work here, Dan, or just a happenstance?
I see there may be some manipulation here. It's kind of a situation of short-term pain for maybe long-term gain, which I think is a very dangerous game they're playing. But
it's hard to see how anybody could pull all those strings at once and really want that to happen. On the other hand, maybe if housing prices get, you know, washed out a bit, I suppose that could be some kind of drag on inflation. Amy Sullivan, what about Dan's bigger, you know, picture that he's painting here of the bill coming due in a new way on lots of fronts, a kind of radical comeuppance fear?
Well, it's certainly true that this is going to, again, add another factor to the campaign to make it even more crowded than it's been so far. I think a lot of us assumed that the big domestic issue of the campaign was going to be health care, and that what would kind of shine a light on the differences between candidates and between the two parties is really in the approach to solving the healthcare crisis. This adds yet another piece to the puzzle here. And we frankly haven't heard that much from the different candidates during the primaries about their economic plans. We've heard a little bit about taxes and what folks would do on that front. We've heard a tiny bit, particularly from the Republican side, about trade policies. But this is something where voters are really going to need to press the candidates on it because it's obviously coming to a head. And it may be one of the important deciding points, along with Iraq and healthcare, that may decide the election.
I want to speak to how Democrats are dealing with that. Edwards and Obama have been tough on Hillary recently, in part questioning just the economic plans and domestic plans. Of course, Bill Clinton came out with the, sort of the swift voting charge, like the fellow Democrats are being too tough on her. Obama said he was stunned by the former president's comments, called them a reach.
We saw what happened the last 7 years when we made decisions in elections based on trivial matters. When we listened to people make snide comments about whether Vice President Gore was too stiff, when they made dishonest claims about the things that he said that he'd done in his life, when that scandalous Swift vote ad was run against Senator Kerry.
Jack Beatty, former president, with a, what is it, a brushback pitch there on the competitors to his wife, now candidate for the White House?
Oh, I think that's way over the top. I mean, you've got to make issue differences and differences on positions and differences on really political character. And I think that's what Obama very late in the game has been doing, and Edwards has been doing more consistently. However, Hillary still has her 20-point lead nationally. Here in New Hampshire, she's gone down, I think, 6 points since the debate performance that was so universally panned. And so we'll have to see what happens there. But, you know, taking it broadly about the Democratic Party, last week I was talking to a woman who said she got a call from the Democratic National Committee asking for a contribution on the day that Senator Schumer and Feinstein said they were going to back Judge Mukasey for Attorney General. And she said, I just wasn't in a giving mood. And, of course, yesterday we had Mr. Mukasey was approved, and there were 40 Democrats who were against him and 4 presidential candidates who weren't there. So there were potentially 44 votes. That's enough, of course, to filibuster. And more than enough. And if the Republicans say 60 is the new 51, but apparently not for the Democratic Party. And I think this is just the latest in a series of severe letdowns this party has made to its base. We could talk about other things like the taxes on the hedge fund people, and the way that the Washington Post documented this week how the Democrats have reversed on that because of the flow of money from the hedge funds to their campaigns. And I think more and more Democrats are just feeling demoralized. And in fact, it was left to Nancy Pelosi to say this week, if she were a Democrat watching the Congress, she would be demoralized as well.
Amy Sullivan, give us a couple of reads then. First, the Democrats on the campaign trail, and then back in Congress. What about Bill Clinton and the effect of him? Do you see it as a warning to other candidates to back off Hillary? And is that effective?
Well, I think President Clinton makes a good point on its own that far too often, particularly folks in my profession, focus on the trivial at the expense of actual substantive differences between the candidates. In this case, I think he's crying Swift boat a little too early because, unfortunately, there will be plenty of opportunities for him to lodge the Swift boat campaign or
post-primary when the GOP and Democrats really duke it out and who knows what gets
you can be sure something will come along and it's a little too early to trot that out. But it is fascinating to kind of watch the dynamics playing out. For a long time, we had the sense that Hillary Clinton was the inevitable nominee. And this is still very much a race. And the next 2 months, particularly, as I said, as voters start to really key in and start to ask the tough questions about these substantive differences on trade, on health care, on education and the environment and all the different issues that so far have seemed to have very few differences between these candidates, you're going to see things start to sell out a little more, particularly in those early states.
Let's go to Linda in the earliest state, Iowa, Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk a little bit about this myth that's gaining ground that somehow Hillary and Bill are divisive. And I think that is a myth that was created by the right, because for 25 years, the only Democrats who were successful on a national stage were the Clintons. So they had to be destroyed. And what they did was they argued several things, corruption. But if you look at that, no one in the Clinton administration was convicted of a crime committed while in office, but 30 were in Reagan's administration, and so for 5 or 6 in Bush's.
So you're going to stay in their corner and say they look like winners and have for a long time. Let's get another one of your fellow Iowans, Jim, in Iowa City. You're on the air. What do you think, Jim?
Well, I was just listening, and I got another comment now, too, but the Democrats are elected to do a job here, and that job is to oppose the bad policies of the Bush administration, and every time something important comes up, they're not doing it, and they're going to make themselves irrelevant. And as far as the comment about the only successful Democrats in the last 25 years being the Clintons, when the DLC and the Clintons took over the Democratic Party, we may not have had the presidency, but we had a majority of governorships, state legislatures, the House and the Senate. We have none of those now.
Well,
we just finally got them back. So the DLC and the Clintons did not do the broader party any favors.
Interesting. We see there it's not only the Republicans who've got their internal tensions this time out. I want to turn to another issue that gets all kinds of politics rolling and see what our panel thinks about it. During passage of a House bill this week that prevents anti-gay discrimination, or would, in the workplace, Congressman Barney Frank, Democrat of Massachusetts, an outspoken gay rights advocate, spoke about the meaning of the moment. Here's an excerpt.
I used to be someone subject to this prejudice. And through luck, circumstance, I got to be a big shot. I'm now above that prejudice. But I feel an obligation to 15-year-olds dreading to go to school because of the torments, to people afraid they'll lose their job in a gas station if someone finds out who they love. I feel an obligation to use the status I have been lucky enough to get to help them.
Barney Frank, openly gay congressman, they're pushing for the anti-discrimination legislation for gays in the workplace. Michael Garrison, is this going to be, you know, values redux next year, this kind of vote by the House? Or, you know, is this behind us somehow?
Well, I actually think in some ways it's an issue that puts the Bush administration and Republicans in a fairly difficult position. The law is narrowly drawn. It was controversial because it didn't include transsexuals, for example. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the objections of Republicans on the floor were mainly that it would lead to endless litigation and that it wouldn't protect religiously oriented businesses like Christian bookstores and things like that, although it would protect hospitals, churches, other things. They could essentially have their own, hiring rules. You know, the administration has said they were had a veto threat on an earlier version, which was much broader. Now they say they're re-examining it. And I think it's difficult because, you know, the internal decision they're going to make is how narrowly drawn is this. Very few people in America support routine business place discrimination against anyone. But is this narrowly drawn enough? That's the decision they're going to have to make.
Jack Beatty, looking forward to next year in the campaign season, do you think we're going back to the big values, culture war interaction here, or with the scale of challenges we see in the economy, on national security and the rest, do those maybe finally take a back seat?
I think that the culture issues are going to take a back seat, and you see it in polling of Republicans. We've been watching it for months now, that the salience of these issues, gay rights, abortion, and so on, has been waning. In fact, down on the list, while fears about terrorism, health care, the economy, the environment, these have risen. And, there are sharp differences there among candidates, but they don't partake of this ultimacy. They don't have this, this moralistic flavor. flavor to them. And I think that that maybe the country is that our problems are so big that the war in Iraq that is trumping these social issues, or at least one hopes so.
I don't want to go out this week without a little sound of the French president in Washington, extraordinary kind of meeting with him and Congress. Here he is talking about, well, lauding the long relationship, and here in particular about young American soldiers who died on the beaches of Normandy and elsewhere during World War II.
The children of my generation have understood that these young 20-year-old Americans were true heroes to whom we owed the fact that we were free people and not slaves. America liberated us, and this is an eternal debt we owe America.
Congress loved that. Amy Sullivan, is the Franco-American meltdown over? Is it all repaired, kissed and made up?
Perhaps. I heard one Republican congressman earlier this week say that he invited the French president to visit the House cafeteria where they no longer serve freedom fries. He couldn't bring himself to say French fries, but he said there were no longer freedom fries.
Maybe soon we can have our French dip and our French fries back. Michael Gerson, what do you think? The White House, President Bush spoke a little French in there. Is he going to welcome the French back on the guest list?
No, I think so. I mean, they've been, you know, helpful on the Darfur issue. They've been helpful on a variety of different terrorism issues. And the relationship with both France and Germany has improved significantly. The German chancellor is down at in Texas now.
Well, Michael Gerson, author of the new book, Heroic Conservatism. Thanks very much for being with us this hour, Michael.
Thank you.
And Amy Sullivan, author of The Party Faithful. We'll look for it, Amy. Thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Amy Sullivan of Time Magazine. Jack Beatty, good to have you.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.